I will go around and greet everybody, starting with Linda and Bob Ota, Marvin, Amelia, Bob and Tiger, Adine, Claudia, Jinryu, Jason, Ellen, Susan, Mark, Sam, Jeannie, Bruce, and Phil, Yeshe, Pat, Shoketsu, Alvaro, Amanda, Jessica, Cinda, and Ruthanne. So let's see. In terms of announcements, this is not going to be relevant to most of you, but let's see. For a while, we had Jukai on the calendar for July 12th, but we realized that doing an in-person ceremony wasn't going to be easy to make that mesh with our Sunday morning online stuff. So we're doing two separate things. We're doing just July 12th to just be a normal Sunday program. And then those who are taking the precepts and want to participate in an in-person ceremony will be doing that in the afternoon out in a park, socially distanced, wearing masks, all that kind of stuff. And then I also wanted to, I mean, just say, I mean, I think everybody knows who's this is relevant to, but there were a couple people who want to take the precepts who are, who prepared for it and are on the list to take the precepts, but the in-person stuff wasn't going to work for, COVID-19 reasons. And so I've decided to forge the crazy new territory of also having an online ceremony. So I never set out to think, oh, you know what would be cool is if you could give the precepts online. But these are, we do what we have to do in these expedient circumstances. So the one piece of that will be that even though it will all be online, each preceptee will have to have a person present, another person present, to put the wagesa over their head and hand them the Jukai certificate. That you never ordain yourself. There has to be somebody else involved. So somebody will kind of stand in as my proxy and put the wagesa over your head. So people have that option if you were taking the precepts. And let's see. Now there are 27 of us. So hello to Frankie and to Paulette. Nice to see you. And let's see, is Ruth Ann still with us? Oh, I don't know if I think I missed, might have missed saying hi to you too, Ruth Ann. You were on another screen. Okay. And also on our Tuesday study, for any of you who are involved in that, this next week we'll be studying the Tenzo Kyokan itself, the Dogen's essay. I had skipped over that and we had just started with chapter one of the book, but we all decided that we'd spend a week on the essay itself. I think that's it. Oh yes, the Awakening to Whiteness class. Do you want to say something about that, Shoketsu?
Yeah, so I was just trying to send you a reminder, a little text. thank you. Yes, so we are going to be having an Awakening to Whiteness series of material out of training, and it's a 6-month re-education and affinity group for white folks to learn together about the systems of white supremacy and racial influence embedded in the structures of American society and culture. So we are going to have a start by having an orientation in July. We're thinking July 11th, which is a Saturday, and the rest of the times the meetings will be in the evenings, on Thursday evenings, 6 to 8. Please contact me if you're interested. There's a lot of really relevant and interesting material that's curated particularly for Buddhists. So I hope you will join us. And you'll learn more about it specifically in the orientation. I took it last year and it was life-changing and mind-changing. Totally.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yes, I took it last time as well, and highly recommend it. I have to confess that honestly, I thought, well, yeah, we had slavery and that was bad. And then since then, there's been some prejudice. Mm-hmm. And yeah, very humbling to realize how much I didn't know. And it's very, very transformative course that I think most of us who took it really, like, especially with what's been going on in our country right now, are like, oh, I'm so glad that I had that basis before encountering this. So I believe if you look on the website, there's a list of dates, but a few of those might change. So if you're interested, you're not sure about the dates, not sure you can make it all, just email Shoketsu and, you know, find out that you might be able to participate even if you're not sure at this point. So. All right.
Yes, just let me know.
And if you don't know Shoketsu's email, you can just email info@brightway and I'll get your inquiry to her. Okay. How much to the Buddha? How much to the Dharma? How much to the Sangha? So today's talk, I'm calling There Is No You There. So I'm going to start off with one of my favorite, a segment from one of my favorite Pali Canon suttas, one that I think Adine mentioned in a conversation recently, the Bahiya Sutta. So in this Pali Canon Sutta, Bahiya is a shramana. He's a holy man, a spiritual seeker, kind of one of those in the woods ascetic spiritual seekers, lots of meditation and study, very, very admirable practice, a very spiritually diligent and advanced person. And at one point, he wonders whether he has attained, you know, kind of the ultimate liberation. And a deva in heaven, who apparently was like related to him in a previous life, kind of overhears what he's thinking and then comes down to say, nope, you haven't attained complete liberation. Matter of fact, you're not even on the right path. And Bahiya, this is quite admirable, he's not defensive. His ego isn't hurt. Most of us would be like, what do you mean? Or else we'd be crushed or something like that. But he says, well, then who in this world with its devas are arhats or have entered the path to arhatship, to complete liberation? So what should I do? Who knows? And so the deva tells him that the Buddha is liberated and that he can teach the way. So Bahiya tracks down the Buddha And somebody says, you know, well, he's not here right now. He's out on his alms round. So Bahia goes and finds him on his alms round and throws himself at his feet and says, please, please, please teach me the Dharma. And the Buddha's like, now's not the time. I, you know, we're on alms round. But Bahia begs, asks, you know, says, no, 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 please. You never know when you might die. I have to know. So he asks three times. And as in the tradition, like once you ask three times, you know, the teacher has to offer you the teaching. So the Buddha gives him this little like, all right, you know, he's busy. He's got a limited amount of time. He's going to give him just the Dharma in a nutshell. So this paragraph is the Dharma in a nutshell. He says, all right, Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In reference to the scene, there will only be the scene. In reference to the heard, only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to the cognized, only the cognized. This is how you should train yourself. When for you there will only be only the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized, then, Bahia, there is no you in connection with that. When there is no you in connection with that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between the two. This, just this, is the end of stress. Or the end of dukkha. So Bahia, because of his extensive practice, already got it immediately and attained complete perfect enlightenment, which was good because then shortly thereafter he was killed by a mad cow. So this is the Dharma in a nutshell. So what does it mean in reference to your perceptions via the five senses? So there's the eye, ear, and then he kind of collapsed, sensed, you know, nose, tongue, and body. Collapsed, sensed into that one category. And then mind, the cognized. So these are the five senses, perceiving our perceptions via the five senses. What does it mean for them to only, it's just them. It's just them in and of themselves. In reference to your perceptions, there is only the perceptions. So this implies, of course, that we usually add something to them, as opposed to them just being the perceptions in the perceptions. We're usually adding something to the perceptions. And what is it we add? We add narratives, stories about ourselves and what's going on, what we might get out of something. Are there any threats? Are there any benefits? Do we like this? Do we not like this? And the stories can be very obvious or very subtle. So I want to draw from one of my favorite books. This is Robert Wright's Why Buddhism is True. The Science and Philosophy of Meditation and Enlightenment. Having been trained as a wildlife biologist and having studied evolution, I find myself very encouraged by these kind of scientific backing up of Buddhism. So he explains, he's talking about a psychologist, the ideas of a psychologist named Paul Bloom, who has written that essentialism, the tendency to attribute inner essences to things, is a human universal. So he says, this is about Bloom's work. The stories we tell about things and thus belief we have about their history and their nature shape our experience of them and thus our sense of their essence. One of his favorite examples is a study that involved wine connoisseurs. 40 of them deemed a Bordeaux with a premium label worth drinking. But only 12 bestowed that honor on a Bordeaux labeled as mere table wine. You probably guessed the punchline. The two kinds of bottles contained one kind of wine. So wine is an especially clear example of how stories inform our pleasures. But Bloom thinks that if you look closely enough, every pleasure has a consequential story behind it. He once said to me, "There's no such thing as a simple pleasure. There's no such thing as a pleasure that's untainted by your beliefs about what you're being pleasured by." He used food as an example. If you hand me something and I taste it, part of my knowledge is that it was given to me by someone I trusted. And I would taste it differently than if I found it on the floor. Or if I paid $1,000 for it. Or take paintings. It's true that you can look at a painting and not know who painted it and just appreciate it largely based on what it looks like. At the same time, you know it's a painting. In other words, it's not a natural occurrence of paint splattered on the wall. Someone made it to for display, and that colors things. So too, he said, with the simplest of sensations, an orgasm, drinking water when you're thirsty, stretching, anything. It's always under some sort of description. It's always viewed as an instant of some sort of category. There was always, in other words, an implied narrative. So that was, you know, specifically about pleasure, but of course it applies to all of our experiences. So then Wright talks about a man without stories. So this guy, a real guy, Gary Weber, so he's done, you know, decades, thousands of hours of meditation, and he claims to be fairly free of all of these stories and narratives. And apparently that you know, you can't really know what somebody's inner experience is, but that he did participate in a study of meditators. And one of the things that they found with meditation is that, you know, after a while of meditating, the area of your brain, so this is when you're hooked up to a functional MRI machine and they can see what's going on in your brain, that after a while of meditating, the area of your brain where the default activity happens quiets down. So the default mode activity is like, that's when our brain, like, we're not, it's not about what's actually happening to us. It's just if we're not directly engaged in an activity or being entertained or something, our brain is just, it's just processing stuff, thinking about stuff, imagining scenarios. So it's all this self-referential processing, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it's just this thing that our brain does. I tend to think of it as like when you used to be able to hook up your computer to the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And when your computer wasn't busy, it would crunch data for this, for SETI. I feel like, you know, we're not engaged in tasks. Our brain is just doing this stuff. But it can end up being, you know, stressful. Or if you're depressed or anxious, your brain gets in loops, and then your default mode is just a stressful loop. So in meditation, we kind of get some of that quiets down. So this guy, apparently, when they tested him, it wasn't just that his default mode area went quiet after some meditation. His default mode was quiet, area was quiet from the beginning. So, sounds like a pretty remarkable person. So he's talking to him to find out what his experience is like. And he describes a world in which things don't have distinctive essences that set them sharply apart from one another. Though Weber, like Smith, can of course tell the difference between a chair and a table and a lamp and responds appropriately to each, These items don't project independent identities as forcefully as they used to. There's a continuity to things. There's not that differentiation between them and their background. Weber says, they're all one stuff. He sometimes describes this stuff that they seem to be made of as a kind of energy, but he says there's no differentiation in energy or how you feel about them. I once tried to get Weber to elaborate on the nature of the enjoyment he gets from the world and how it differs from the enjoyment I get from the world. I said, so you're saying, I gather, that there is a kind of pleasure you can derive via your senses that does not constitute emotional involvement of a problematic kind. That's correct, he said, but he hastened to add, you haven't lost your nerve endings. Green tea still tastes like green tea. Red wine still tastes like red wine. You don't lose that. What you lose is the carry forward of that sensation. This is a fantastic glass of wine. This was a great year. But I pointed out, some people would say that if you don't at least consider it a good glass of wine, if you don't get emotionally involved enough to like the wine, then there's not much point in living. He answered, but it's a much cleaner perception. If I'm tasting a glass of wine and I'm trying to impress some restaurant critics or some friend who's a great wine fancier, then I may have a story going. I may have an expectation for how this wine should be and how I should expect it to taste. So it really blocks my clear, simple perception. So by getting this thought out of the way, this emotional thought out of the way, I have a much higher likelihood of directly perceiving whatever the sensation is. So Wright goes on to describe how he feels like he's had some of this experience himself because he's done some meditation retreats. And for those of you who have done that, you might have noticed that there can be a settling and a simplicity where you'd just be, you know, eating food, and you have to eat it in silence, which is, you know, different than usually you're just talking or distracting yourself or something. So they're just eating in silence, and suddenly what's actually very, very simple food is really, really delicious. that it's not like, oh my goodness, this is, you know, fancy restaurant. This is, oh, gorgonzola. No, I mean, it's like it's steamed broccoli, but somehow steamed broccoli can taste just wonderful. So I want to just break out into a short breakout session and ask, what is your experience of being caught up in stories? Or, you know, in a related note, like, recognizing stories or being able to drop stories. So I will just invite you all. It looks like there's probably a few of you who haven't been assigned, so I'll add you in a moment. Okay. So stories, not necessarily bad things. One of the things that we were talking about in our group is, you know, being writers, wanting to share with other people, that kind of thing. But sometimes, you know, we can be very, very caught in our stories. And so that piece that I read about this guy who lives without stories, I think I want to emphasize that, like so many aspects of our practice, this isn't an either-or thing. You know, either you're all caught up in stories, or you're walking around in some rarefied state where you're beyond stories. This is this is something that we experience gradually over the course of our practice, becoming more and more free from our stories. So I'll just share my story that, you know, before practice, which for me was early 20s and in college. And I was just completely stuck in my narrative. I'm this kind of person. This is what I believe. This is what is right and wrong. This is what I want. This is how the world is failing to measure up to my hopes and expectations. This is what is deficient in my life. This is what I must figure out. This is what is going to happen if I don't figure it out. When I was with people, this is going well. This is fun. These people like me. Or this is not going well. These people don't like me. We don't have a good relationship. What I didn't understand, I furiously worked at creating a narrative for that would stick, that would help me have a sense of understanding and control. Reminds me of a comic I saw once of shortly after one of our terrible mass shootings, where this guy is walking around with a big cloud hanging over his head. And everybody around him is all similarly walking with this dark cloud over their head. But then they find boxes. They create boxes. And like, here's gun control. And then I can take my ambiguity and my sadness and I can put it in this box. I'm good. Now it's, now I've got a box around it. It's not affecting me the same way. That's how I felt like what I was trying to do with my narratives, with my stories. And I paid much more attention to my own stories than what was actually going on around me. So even though my life was fine in an objective sense, I was miserable. It was exhausting trying to create and maintain those narratives. And everything is elusive and shifting in reality. So positive narratives are fragile and vulnerable. They last for a while, but then something changes and that narrative doesn't work anymore. Negative narratives were just depressing, but they seem kind of true. So the blessing of the Dharma, it never, ever would have occurred to me that it was possible to let go of my stories. I mean, unless somebody told me that, I don't know that I think that's what the miracle of the Buddha is, right? That the story is that here's somebody who just on their own said, wait a second, I think the brain can work differently. That there was a better way to live. Stories seem so essential to us, but it turns out Buddhism and modern psychology agree that our stories, as lovely as they can be sometimes, as useful as they can be sometimes, are really just our explanation of what is happening. They're just our explanation of what's happening to us, what has happened to us. So I've talked about this experiment from Wright's that Wright talks about in his book before, but essentially they did split brain experiments. So some people, because of they have a seizure problem is usually why it is, they will actually sever the two hemispheres of the brain. So they're no longer connected. And this helps alleviate some of the seizures. And apparently these folks operate just fine, actually, except in certain circumstances. So they exploited this this separation by having these folks, they would see something only with one side of their visual field. So the left side of the brain is language and the right is imagery and other things. So anyway, they would show an image to the left eye, so it would only go to the right brain. So these folks would not report having seen the image. They would not be able to say, oh yeah, well then I saw a nut. But if they put their hand in a container that had a bunch of objects in it, they would pick out a nut. So you know, they were being, their behavior was being informed by what they had perceived only with their right brain, not in a really conscious way. They were being influenced. So they would also like sometimes give them the command walk. And these folks would get up, often get up and walk. Now the interesting thing is that then when you ask them why they were doing what they were doing, they would immediately come up with a very reasonable explanation that had nothing to do with like an image was shown to the right hemisphere of my brain and it made me do something. Of course, they didn't even perceive that. They would come up, they would say, oh, I'm thirsty, I'm going to get a Coke. I mean, just like that, just like that, instantly, there's an explanation for what they're doing. So Wright was talking about, you know, this is not something you can really prove, but evolutionarily, this makes sense, that we would evolve the ability to communicate and to explain to each other, but also to ourselves, why are we doing what we're doing? So he has this example of like, if we're in a hunter-gatherer group, you know, and you're deciding who you're going to go hunting with tomorrow, and I say, you know, I got up to go for a walk because I was thirsty, you know, then I seem like a reasonable person that you can trust, like I'm in control of my own actions. But if I say, I don't know why I got up to go get, I don't know, I just found myself walking, then chances are you're not going to want to go hunting with me. So we evolved this way of explaining what was going on, but frequently they've shown that this conscious narrative is not, it doesn't come first, it comes after. We're motivated by a lot of things, but that narrative is really more of an explanation after the fact. So it has a utility. It is about us trying to understand, make sense of what's happening, make sense of our own motivations. So of course it has a value. So why would such a simple exercise of the perceived there is only the perceived, why would that be the answer to our problems? As I said, stories have their usefulness. Actually, we have a responsibility to try and understand and explain what's going on in the world, right? Helps us navigate human relationships, make decisions. But stories can also be burdens and limitations, as I mentioned earlier. Things are always shifting, so positive narratives are vulnerable and fragile. So we'll see this frequently with people, right? That you have a sense, or somebody has a sense, I am a responsible person, or I am a kind person. And all of a sudden you encounter another person or a group that thinks that you're terrible and mean and vicious and nasty. And all, I mean, that's just like, that now your narrative of yourself as a kind, generous person is threatened. Or I am a competent person and now I just got fired. Whatever. So those narratives are fragile. Negative ones, like I said, can be terribly painful. They can be like being trapped in hell. Reality is complicated. There's much we don't understand and can't predict, can't summarize neatly, can't actually put it in a box. But if we're trying, that can be exhausting. And at the very least, our stories prevent us from fully experiencing our lives. So like the man without stories, he's just tasting, he's just hearing, he's just enjoying. And our stories always presume a self. So all of the narratives, like we are the protagonist in all of the narratives, even if they're about other people, even if they're about the world, it's our understanding of the world. And once we have a presumed a self, there arises concern for I, me, and mine. So how do we practice with this? How do we become freer from our stories? I guess we begin to question, to investigate. You know, you attend a Dharma talk. Huh, and talking about stories. What about stories? Makes me more conscious of my stories throughout the next week. Like, huh, look, that's a story. And then asking ourselves, who am I without the story? Is my safety and happiness dependent on this story? And we certainly practice this doing Zazen. It's part of what we're doing sitting there is trying to let go of the story about what's happening, who we are, what's good and bad. But really, it's perceiving our stories as just stories. So part of the Vahiya Sutta is, in the cognized, there's just the cognized. So our story is just part of what is going on in our brain. But if we perceive our story as just a story, we perceive it as not just a story in a dismissive way, but that's what it is. We perceive it as a story, as something that is going on in our brain. Then it becomes equal to everything else that is happening, rather than being the driving force, the truth, the filter through everything with which everything else is interpreted. And when we can drop these stories, when we can, or at least recognize them as stories, not be as invested in them, it can be very, very liberating. So my prime example is, some of the most overpowering, captivating, intoxicating stories, right, are the ones about human relationships, or having an issue with this person, and they are like this, and they are causing this problem, and they don't understand this, and, you know, so we build up a whole story about this relationship, and it can be just, that's the kind of thing that can be stuck in our heads for so long, be so upsetting. But if we can recognize this as just a story, this is our best understanding of what's going on, but that's all it is. This is my best understanding. This is my description, my best guess about what's going on. And that's all it actually is. It is not, I was thinking it's our best explanation, but not a law that binds us. It's not inherently true. So with that, I will leave it for a few questions and comments.
Do you think there's such a thing as being welcoming and friendly to stories?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, totally.
They're really interesting, but you don't have to be the story. You can just say, "Wow, there it is again," and you know, kind of be interested and curious about. I wonder what about that story is so fixed that I must keep doing it.
Yeah, earlier today I mentioned when people were online beforehand, this little story that pops into my head whenever I'm on one of these Zoom meetings and I start talking and like nobody cares what I say. Nobody cares, nobody's listening. They just keep talking as if I'm not even there, and then I realize I'm on mute. like there, woo! There all of a sudden this big story appears. So if I can look at it and just like, oh, isn't that interesting?
I have a question about the story is still there, but the story has shifted. And so this comes from one of the Touching the Earth exercises with Thich Nhat Hanh. And so he mentions often in the about how his mother is still with him. And he sees her in the flowers and he sees her this way and that way. in nature and all around her, so that basically, even though she's not in a bodily form, she is still here with him. Or here, not necessarily with him, but she's still present. So is that, would you consider that a story?
Yeah. I guess I would consider that a story that is an explanation, a description of that feeling of being storyless, and yet it's being made into a story, which is okay, right? We talked about the beauty of communication, and we have to. This is what we do as human beings. But I think that's a great point, because in a way, this experience of being without stories is without stories. It's even without that, oh, what a beautiful sunset. Oh, I feel so connected. I mean, that's a little bit of a story that we're putting on it, right?
Yeah.
So, but that's okay. But ultimately, what we're looking for is to be able to experience those moments of really being free from story entirely, not just replacing a particular, a not very nice story with a more pleasant story. That's a good point.
Have you ever been asked, or asked yourself, someone else, after, you know, in order to get to know them, what's your story? Huh? Have you ever done that or had that done to you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, we've got a term student program, and that's what we do. We get together and we tell each other our life stories. And after a while, I began to realize that it's like you can never telling a story felt to me like, painting a sunset. I'm not saying that I've summarized the sunset now. Tomorrow I might want to paint it in a different way. But there's still something beautiful and valuable about, like, this is how it looks to me right now. So that's what I started to learn after having done this life story thing, 10 times. Like, how am I going to paint it this time? Frankie, were you going to say something? You're still muted. There you go.
I was just thinking, as we do this life story exercise year after year, our life story changes, which is a very interesting thing to ponder, that our stories can change. Our stories can change, and they do, as we become more and more open to nothingness, to emptiness, I guess.
Something you said a few minutes ago, Domio, reminded me of David Loy's book, The World is Made of Stories. And the thing in particular that, he makes the point how the work of storying, or the process of storying among people, can be very beneficial, particularly if it's conscious. And on the other hand, as cultures, we make up these stories about each other that can be very pernicious and manipulative. But so it's not enough to, in a way, it's not enough to acknowledge that we've got stories going on. Our awareness of it and thinking about using it for good, or just seeing how it operates, is really valuable.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the kind of thing where, like, we need stories to operate, or views. I know that's one of the things I love. Houston Smith, in his book, Why Religion Matters, he says, we think that in the scientific age, that we've gotten rid of those outdated views. But he says, you always have a view. Now we just have a view that nothing frickin' matters. Now we have a view, it's all just a nihilistic void and there's nothing redeeming. So, I mean, you're just, you can't not have a view. You can't. So if you're conscious of it, then you can make some different choices about that. Anybody who hasn't spoken yet?
I was going to say that as I get older, I have more stories that turned out not to be true. So it's easier to now wonder, well, is this story true? So.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. All right. Well, I will close with a verse then. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time. All honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas. Wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you all for being here. Have a good rest of your day.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks. Bye.